I will work day in and day out, wake up and smell the coffee.
I want to return to the European Union.
Another future is possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Michaela Wrong, a journalist for many years with Reuters and the Financial Times, author of 5 books on Africa, including the book that we're going to be discussing today, Do Not Disturb, The Story of a Political Murder and an African Regime Gone Bad. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you all. Now, the first question I'd like to ask is, what made you decide to write this particular book?
Yes. Well, what happened was in January 2014, January the 1st, I began noticing emails doing the rounds amongst my correspondent friends, my reporter friends, who were saying amongst themselves, have you seen what's happened to Patrick? And I was like, who are you talking about? Because it turns out I've got about 3 or 4 journalist friends who are called Patrick. And I was thinking, oh God, this sounds like bad news. Mm. And it turned out that actually they were talking about Patrick Karegaya, who was Rwanda's former head of external intelligence. And who, you know, everyone on the group had known because we had all covered Rwanda post-genocide in 1994. He had quickly established himself as a very sort of smooth and charming kind of press man. He was head of external intelligence, but he was also the guy who used to hang out with the journalists, who would schmooze them, who would kind of organize presidential interviews, who'd sort of butter them up and give them the official narrative. And what had happened is he'd been strangled in a hotel room in South Africa, the Michelangelo Hotel, lured to that hotel by a businessman friend, a Rwandan businessman friend who he clearly trusted. And it looked pretty clear that it had just been a trap, an ambush set up. And what was really shocking was it was clear that this was set up by the Rwandan state. And therefore, that meant that Rwanda's President Paul Kagame had basically ordered the assassination of one of his oldest friends, because Patrick Karegaya and Paul Kagame went way back. They'd known each other since they were children. They'd been to the same schools together. They had been rebels together in Uganda, joined the Rwandan Patriotic Front. So this was a very personal assassination. And I think we were all a bit stunned. And after sort of looking and reading up on what had happened, slowly, took me a while, I began to think, this is a really fascinating story and it needs to be told. And at the start, I assumed that other people were probably also thinking the same thing and had already started. And in fact, what I realized when I finally contacted his family was that nobody wanted to touch this subject with a barge pole, because it was so controversial. And because writing it would basically mean taking on board this entire image that Paul Kagame, the president, has constructed of himself and of Rwanda ever since the genocide, and basically sort of knocking holes in that image.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you've given a bit of insight into the kind of situation in the book, but could you give us a bit of an overview as to who Paul Kagame is and how he came to power in Rwanda?
Yes, I think he's a fascinating individual. Like a lot of heads of state or driven leaders, you'll often find that they came from quite disadvantaged background. That was certainly the case. He came from an aristocratic royal family or members of the Tutsi minority in Rwanda originally, but his family, like most of the members of that royal court, were expelled from Rwanda in the late 1950s, early 1960s, and they fled into neighboring countries. A lot of them established themselves in southwest Uganda, living in refugee camps where they were reliant on World Food Program rationing and were really kind of so aristocrats who had been brought low because there'd been a revolution. The Hutu revolution had taken inside Rwanda, and the majority of Hutus had overturned the Tutsi aristocracy and seized power. And so he had a tough upbringing, and I think that has really left its mark on him. He then went on. He was a bit of a feckless youth. went on to be recruited by Yoweri Museveni in Uganda to join the National Resistance Movement, which was a guerrilla group that Yoweri Museveni set up to take on Ugandan President Milton Obote. So he learned early on, he became a guerrilla. He was trained in intelligence work in Tanzania. And when Yoweri Museveni's NRM seized power in 1986, Kagame was one of a group of people from that community, that Banyarwanda community, as it was known, to get high-ranking positions in the new Ugandan army. And there, along with his friend, he was one of a group who clustered around Fred Rejema, who was his friend. And Fred Rejema was the most charismatic of these young Banyarwanda fighters. And they decided that they wanted to take the skills they had acquired, thanks to all that experience being rebels, guerrilla fighters under Yoweri Museveni, take those skills and go back home. And that meant going back to Rwanda across the border and taking with them their weapons, their training, their experience, their understanding of guerrilla warfare. And they did that in 1990. And what happened was that Fred Rejema, who was this adored young leader, was killed on day two of that invasion in 1990. And Kagame then took his place. And you see this change very early on, because Kagame was a very different kettle of fish. And while he was very much respected by the people in what was then had already been called the Rwandan Patriotic Front, he was feared rather than loved. And he knew it. He knew that he wasn't anything like as popular as Fred Rejema. And some of people refer to him as an accidental president. And so he becomes this sort of key figure. For a long time, he's not officially the leading the leader of the RPF, but everyone knows that really he's running the show. This is the movement that took power in Rwanda in 1994 after the genocide. There are widespread suspicions that it was the RPF that brought down the plane on which Juvenal Habyarimana, the president, the Hutu president of Rwanda, was traveling, which triggered the genocide. They took power in July that year after between 500,000 and 800,000 people died. And then they began, refashioning and rebuilding the country, because the genocide was, of course, one of the most devastating events in recent African history. And the place was in ruins, and a huge proportion of the Hutu population had fled because they didn't want to be living in a country ruled by the RPF. They were terrified of this movement. So they were living in refugee camps on the outskirts. So the RPF set about rebuilding the country, luring back or sort of donor support. They needed a lot of foreign aid in the early years. There was a sort of hardcore group of very, very intelligent RPF leaders. Patrick Karagaya was just one of them. He was the head of intelligence, but there were also a key set of generals. And what you see with the years passing is that that group of RPF, sort of that elite that had come mostly from Uganda, was English speaking. Slowly, its members begin to fall out with Kagame, and they end up being jailed or fleeing the country because they think their lives are in danger, or being assassinated. And they flee abroad, and many of them, this sort of hardcore of them, set up this opposition group known as the Rwanda National Congress. That was one of the group that Patrick Karagaya was a co-founder of. And they start to denounce Paul Kagame as a dictator, and to say, pointing out that he is rigging elections, that he doesn't tolerate political dissent, that journalists are disappearing or being killed, and that this is not what they fought for. This is not, why they invaded the country and took on the former Hutu army. So I think now you have a real dichotomy, because on the one hand, Paul Kagame has been extremely adept at courting seducing the West. So not just the West. I mean, he seems to be constantly jetting around the world now, walking along red carpets, you know, military parades and his mother. And he's, you know, constantly being invited to places like Davos or to give speeches. And he's regarded as this great sort of the man who saved Rwanda and rebuilt Rwanda. And Rwanda is tailed as a development miracle story. But there's also a huge amount of contestation from members, not only of his own country, but his own state, but also his own Tutsi minority, who is saying, no, you know, this is not what it seems. This is a really frighteningly repressive country where freedom of thought is completely crushed, you know, where demonstrations never happen, where the head of the opposition, Victoire Ingabire, spent 8 years in jail and is now under house arrest. You know, this man is not what he seems and not what he is widely hailed as and praised for being. So I think there's a real schism now between how Kagame is seen often in the West and how he's seen by, you know, the people who knew him best.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, as part of Kagame's regime, the genocide, as you touched upon, is very much wrapped up in that. I mean, how well understood do you think the Rwandan genocide is internationally? It's certainly something that I think quite a lot of people know about, but do you think it's something that they fully understand as to what actually happened?
No, I don't think they do understand it, because what you're seeing, sadly, is, and this started right, you know, from the get-go, and one of the things I say in my book is that I fell for it just as much as anybody. I try to be honest about that, is that you have this sort of scenario painted in which there is only one group of victims, and they are all members of the Tutsi minority. You know, their deaths, their massacres, these horrific massacres that undoubtedly took place. I mean, I was there and saw the traces of the massacres and saw the bodies. You know, those are commemorated every year on April the 6th, and there's a genocide memorial. There are many genocide memorials. And if you visit the country, you will be taken to see them. But the trouble is, it's a partial story. Firstly, one of the elements I find most disturbing is the way in which the figures are being routinely inflated. So if you look at the kind of figures for the death toll of people strictly killed during that genocide, that whole genocide chapter at the beginning in the 1990s, and what is being cited now, you see people talking, not only, you know, do they use the 1 million figure, but there are now government officials in Rwanda who routinely will talk about 2 million. And so you sort of see this sort of massive inflation of figures as though this is sort of is a special pleading, because one of the things that the Rwandan government worked out early on is that there was no better way to get the sympathy of the world and the indulgence of the world and a tolerance of maybe hardline authoritarian measures being introduced by Kagame than to constantly remind the world that it did nothing to stop the genocide taking place. So there's that element, which is this sort of inflation of figures. And then the one-sided element, which is really key, is that what the years, as the years have gone by, more and more evidence has emerged. And there was quite a lot of evidence at the start, but a lot of the donors, the diplomats, didn't really want to focus upon it, because the emphasis was on, you know, we have to rebuild this country. This is a government we can work with, a new government. Let's work with them. But the evidence that has emerged now of atrocities and massacres committed by Kagame's RPF after it invaded in 1990 and before the plane came down in 1994, there's more and more memoirs and testimony from Hutu survivors about the deaths the massacres carried out by the RPF. And then also we know from the reports drawn up by American investigator Robert Gersony that there were mass killings by the RPF taking place, you know, almost immediately after the RPF seized power in Kigali, inside Rwanda. There's been absolutely damning testimony that the RPF, when it chased down the members of the Hutu army and Hutu extremists who were responsible for the genocide, it crossed the border in support of a rebel movement called the AFDL. It hunted them down in the forests of Congo. There were 617 separate incidents. And when we say incidents, what we mean is massacres. Yeah. The UN has investigated these incidents in great depth. There's absolutely no doubt. And people believe, it's absolutely, certain that tens of thousands of people died in those incidents. It's quite likely that hundreds of thousands of people were killed. Nobody ever talks about these dead. And when they are talked about, for example, the Congolese gynecologist Dennis Mukwege is constantly harping on about these deaths and these massacres, because there's been absolutely no follow through in terms of trials or official inquiries. It's just, people just want to forget about this. Whereas, we see endless sort of emphasis on bringing to book the people who committed the genocide, the last sort of genocidaire who are still in hiding abroad. The UN just recently arrested somebody in Cape Town, a former police officer with huge amounts of blood on his hands, by the sound of it. So it's a very partial history. It's a history in which, only one side of the equation is ever being held to account and being lambasted in public, and the other player, because the other player now holds power in Rwanda, gets off scot-free.
Mm. How much do you think France's role in the events surrounding the genocide is recognised? Because there is a clear debate over France's involvement just before the genocide started, isn't there?
Yeah, well, I mean, France had a long tradition, as did the US, and the UK, of supporting certain favoured strongmen during the Cold War in particular. And one of its favoured strongmen was Mobutu in Zaire, and the another one was Juvenal Habyarimana in Rwanda. So when his regime came under attack by the RPF, France, very much sort of saw its role as saving the regime, propping it up militarily, and so we know that the French were in there training the army, and that meant that these militias, the Interahamwe, who were sort of extracurricular. Mm. Offshoot of the army were also benefiting from French training. And all of that came under a microscope after Kagame's rebel group took over. And for a long time, the French position, was, we regard these people as rebel usurpers. And there was even an attempt to arrest Kagame one time when he was traveling through Paris. And the French had also played a rather mischievous role in that they were so loyal to their client state that they had helped, as the government in Kigali fell apart and the RPF marched across the country, they'd helped to evacuate some of the worst criminals responsible. These were high-ranking people in the Habyarimana regime who had committed who had sort of been responsible for sending out orders to the people who committed the genocide. France had played a really fairly disgraceful role, and for a long time the French were in denial about that, and there was very bad relations with the RPF, and this really culminated in the moment where an investigating magistrate decided to issue arrest warrants against key members of the RPF and accused them of bringing down Juvenal Habyarimana's plane. And so that really was a sort of low point in relations. But what we've seen in recent years is that at a certain point, and this already had happened under Nicolas Sarkozy, the president, and Nicolas Sarkozy, that there was a determination to sort of turn things around, admit that France had sort of, you know, done wrong in Rwanda, and that, you know, its record was a pretty shameful one. And so there was a whole investigation launched in France, which produced the Duclair report. Emmanuel Macron, following in the footsteps of Sarkozy, ended up going to Kigali to shake hands with Kagame and to admit, I mean, there was not an official apology, but to admit that that France had sort of played a, you know, a collaborative role, that there was a certain level of French complicity in the genocide. So that was a pretty remarkable turnabout. I'm afraid I see this as a very cynical period. I think in France, when I read what the French press is writing about Kagame, I think there's a sense of, because there's a profound sense of shame about France's record in Rwanda, there's also a disinclination to perhaps acknowledge that Kagame himself is not exactly a choir boy, and that he's got a huge amount of blood on his hands, and that he's also playing a very, very destructive role, thanks to his frequent military interventions over the years, over the decades, into neighboring Congo in destabilizing the entire region. I mean, it's pretty widely acknowledged now, including by the UN and including by France, that Rwanda is supporting and arming and equipping the M23 rebel movement that is laying waste to eastern Congo. So that's all Paul Kagame's work. But there's a disinclination to face that fact because France is so embarrassed about the role that François Mitterrand, the socialist president, played in supporting Juvenal Habyarimana, who was the president who oversaw a genocide. He didn't oversee it because he died before it started, but who, you know, he was certainly responsible for the creation of a toxic society in which the genocide became, you know, then followed upon that. I think, you know, I look at France, I think, wow, you're making exactly the same mistake as you did when Mitterrand was supporting Habyarimana. You are, you're absolutely uncritically supporting an African dictator who is, you know, destabilizing the entire region. And the reason France is doing it is very cynical as well, because it has interests in places like Mozambique. It's got a Total liquefied gas installation that was threatened by a jihadist movement. It's finding itself, its troops and its ambassadors increasingly are being shown the door in Western Africa and the Sahel region. And it realizes that it can get Rwanda to send forces to those countries and protect French interests. And so there's been a deal done with Kagame, and you know, Kagame is back getting a lot of French aid again. I mean, a nice fat package of aid was announced. I think it was a year and a half ago. So it seems to me that you're seeing a sort of history repeating itself, and I find it sort of unbelievable that the French can't see that this is exactly the same game that turned sour on them back in 1994, and that, you know, if you support a dictator who has absolutely no compunction in ordering sort of, you know, mass killings when he feels it suits his purpose, this will come back to bite you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, on that point, why do you think that the international community hasn't done more to tackle Kagame's regime, and why do you think it is so keen to roll out the red carpet for him? He's currently chair of the Commonwealth. It seems quite extraordinary given what he's doing in his own country and outside it to those who criticise his regime, the way that the international community is responding to him. Why do you think it's responding in that way?
Well, I think at the start, there was a real sense of guilt over the West's failure to intervene to stop the genocide. And that worked, you know, that was a card that the Rwandans could keep playing very effectively for a long time. And therefore, there was a sense of such guilt that, no one wanted to look too closely at the RPF's own record. Then I think what we saw happening, and I think not enough attention is paid to this, is that you saw Rwanda realizing that if it could present itself and play the game of being a developmental miracle, it would be allowed all sorts of leeway. And so you see a very small state that has worked out how to tick the various boxes that really impress development officials. And so, you know, on sustainable development goals, Rwanda always scores brilliantly well, you know, maternal health, on COVID, anti-COVID measures, on primary school education, all those boxes, it ticks. And this is very important to the West, because the West sort of spent decades, you know, sending aid, foreign aid into Africa. And, you know, there's a huge amount of cynicism amongst Western publics who are saying, well, what have we got to show for it? But, you know, in Rwanda, there's this sort of shining beacon of apparent developmental success. And then, you know, development officials will say, okay, yes, it's not a democracy, but you know, where is? And anyway, that's none of our business. My answer to that is always, if you look at the figures a little more closely, the statistics, the record is nothing like as impressive as Rwanda likes to make out, and that there's a lot of wishful thinking on the part of Western donors. But finally, I would say that there are now some very special, specific interests that the West is pursuing, and that Rwanda has learned how to sort of cater to those needs. So France needs fighters. It needs African fighters to do the fighting that French troops used to do in Africa and no longer can, because they're not welcome. So you see Rwandan forces deploying around that Total installation in Mozambique, which is set to start working again, having been rendered inactive by that jihadist rebel group. So France has got every interest in supporting Kagame. It's a kind of, it's like Rwanda's playing the role of Wagner for France. You know, it's their mercenary force that can be deployed at short notice and extremely effectively, because everyone is agreed that the Rwandan army is really very good at what it does. And in Britain here, you know, what you see, and this is a plan that we see, Denmark was also quite keen on rolling out a similar plan. Germany's been talking in similar terms, that you see the offshoring of asylum processing with this negotiation between Britain and Rwanda. Which the deal signed so that all illegal asylum seekers coming to the UK would be flown immediately to Rwanda to have their requests processed there. Now, this has hit the courts and is in trouble in the courts. So we had an initial ruling, you know, last year that, yes, it was legal. And then recently on appeal, the judge said, no, it isn't legal. Mm. And it's going to go to the Supreme Court probably around Christmas time. And my own view is that no one will ever go to Rwanda because by the time, you know, we have a Supreme Court ruling, we'll be in pre-election mode and it will just not be a priority. But I could be proved wrong. But that means that ever since that deal was signed between Priti Patel, our former Home Secretary, and Rwanda, that the Brits simply won't utter a single word of criticism about what they see Rwanda doing at home, locking up journalists, crushing the opposition, kidnapping and staging kangaroo court trials of people like Paul Rusesabagina, the hotelier, and also, you know, Rwanda's intervention in Congo and in support of the M23. The British government simply won't say a word about that. ever since Priti Patel signed the deal, because of course that will be very embarrassing to criticize Kigali just at the time where Suella Braverman, the new Home Secretary, is busy telling everyone what a safe place, what a wonderful place it is to send asylum seekers. So basically, by signing that deal, the UK has censored itself. And it's really striking if you compare what the UK says now about Rwanda in public and what it used to say about Rwanda, the concerns it used to raise about the harassment of journalists, the mistreatment of prisoners in jail, disappearances, arbitrary arrest, all of these things where, you know, he used to publicly say it was very concerned about them. Now it won't say a word. And it's really striking that the UK's position, if you compare it to the US, which is very vocal on all these issues, I mean, they're now speaking a completely different language. And I think it's just really sad to see the way in which a right-wing government here in the UK has basically nobbled itself because it was so desperate to get rid of illegal immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that part of the way that the government is able to make the justification of Rwanda being a safe country for asylum seekers is the genocide? Because it's certainly something that I've seen mentioned by some Conservative MPs. Do you think that they're taking on the similar sort of language that perhaps Kagame's regime has used in regards to the genocide and using it as a way to, you know, you can't criticise the Rwandan government because of that?
Well, yes, absolutely. It's what the Rwandans have always done, which is whenever you criticise, and Kagame does this always when he is criticised in public, he will literally say to people, you know, who are you to criticise our human rights record? Where were you when my people were being massacred in the streets, you know, stopped at checkpoints and cut down with machetes? The problem is, as we all know, two wrongs don't make a right. So the fact that the international community did not really behave as well as we would have liked it done during the genocide does not mean that Kagame should be allowed to get away with what is basically an appalling human rights record, both at home and abroad in his neighbouring countries.
Mm-hmm. Just broadening out to Africa as a continent. Why do you think that both politicians and the public often think of Africa in only monolithic terms? That there are so many people outside of Africa who seem to confuse Africa as a continent with the diverse and varied nations that make it up? Because, you know, Africa is clearly an incredibly diverse continent. Rwanda is very different from Egypt, from Morocco, from Uganda, etc. Why do you think there's that willingness to try and lump all of Africa together by both some politicians and some members of the public?
Yeah, I mean, I as somebody who has spent nearly 30 years now writing about Africa and traveling around Africa, I'm constantly stunned by how different the various countries, you know, 54 countries, how diverse they are, how different their histories are, their cultural traditions, their social issues. And also, I'm always struck by how little people in the West know about them and know about the differences. And I think, you know, there are reasons for this. I mean, one of the reasons is we have a generation now. The people who used to have maybe members of the family who were colonial officers who had served in Ghana or Kenya or Nigeria, or you know, went out to South Africa to work in the mines or ran Shell that generation is dying off, you know. So that link it has gone. Maybe, you know, some of us had grandparents who had sort of worked trying to sort of roll that education in various parts of Africa, and they're gone now. And we're not doing that anymore. So that link has been broken. I think there are also some really solid reasons. I mean, very few of us go on holiday to Africa. If we do go on holiday to Africa, we'll only go to certain safe seen as safe places, like, you know, Kenya, South Africa, Tanzania, to push. So, you know, there's not that sort of, I went there on holiday and therefore I know where it is. And I know it's different, that Kenya's different from Tanzania and that both of them are different from Uganda. That kind of knowledge isn't there. But I used to work for the Financial Times, and what really struck me was that how little economic reporting I ever did for the Financial Times. They were interested in what was going on politically because it had massive implications. But the reason, you know, I very rarely wrote an economic story out of Africa, and it was because, you know, economically, financially, Africa was completely irrelevant most of the time. You know, the African continent still only accounts for 3% of world trade, which is absolutely tiny. And so, you know, there's not that need to know about Africa because it's going to impact on all of us. Africa will impact on all of us, and not because of world trade, but because of, you know, probably because of climate change and the migrant issue. But I think, you know, we tend to know about places that really matter to us in a series of personal ways or financial, economic, or political ways. And Africa often just seems a bit irrelevant. So I think that's probably the reason. I have to say that, you know, as the West sort of continues to fail to understand Africa or get to grips with its particularities, other nations are engaging with it more. And, you know, what you're seeing is a sort of stage in which the US, the UK, and even France, you know, are no longer big players in the way they used to be in Africa. And what you're seeing instead is, China's a very big player. Russia's sniffing around now. Turkey, Lebanon, United Arab Emirates. These are countries that are engaging with Africa. And I think, we've reached a post-Cold War era in which, the players are different. And the West is largely looking at Africa in terms of, you know, the problems posed by jihadism. That's really the main concern for capitals in the West. You know, is Africa going to become a breeding ground for the kind of Islamic extremism that proved to be such a challenge and such a danger in the Middle East? But otherwise, there's a sort of pulling back, I think. I think that's been gradual and a steady pulling back and pulling out.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, we're coming towards the end of the podcast, Michaela. Thank you for taking the time to speak to me. But I do have one final question. In regards to the book, what do you hope people, when they have finished reading it, will take away from it? What do you hope that you will most be able to impress upon anybody who's either reading the book or has just finished the book?
Well, I think there are two things. One is I in my books are very accessible, and they focus often on personalities, individuals. And I do that because, you know, when you've been in these countries and spent time in them, you realize what sort of Shakespearean characters you're often describing, and these kind of extraordinary itineraries they've been on, and these sort of rise and fall of empires. And it's been a privilege for me to be able to comment and write about them and interview often the key players. And I just want to convey that because, you know, it isn't just a sort of 54 undifferentiated countries. These are extraordinary, turbulent histories and larger than life characters who have shaped the destiny of Africa. And I hope that by writing in an accessible way and drawing out these complex individuals, that people will sort of get it and sort of remember, you know, who these people are and how these countries were shaped and have changed, because they've all gone through dramatic changes. If you look at Uganda, Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda over the last, you know, 25, 30 years. I mean, my God, what a series of dramatic events they've been through. But the other thing is, more specifically towards Rwanda, I do think that there's been a sort of Potemkin village constructed around Rwanda. I often think of the analogy between the kind of great press and admiration that the left used to give Stalin, you know, early on in his reign, when, you know, before we knew that so many people had died as a result of his policies and the sort of nastiness and brutality of it all. And I think, you know, that similarly with Kagame, that this is a very, this is one of the most repressive regimes in Africa today. And is it is weird and disturbing to see it being routinely praised in the way it currently is. And I in writing my book, I was just sort of wanting to say to people, do you even know who you're dealing with? Because this is not the man. You know, I have interviewed him a couple of times, and I have seen, you know, what the RPF, how it has changed and morphed, and what it now represents in Africa, what it's doing in the region. And you think, you know, you really need to inform yourselves rather better. And in terms of Britain, I mean, the idea that we would be sending people who are fleeing persecution to this repressive country that is Rwanda, I mean, it's just surreal. So I wrote the book long before the Priti Patel signed her deal with Paul Kagame. But I would just like a certain sense of reality to crystallize in here in the West.
Absolutely. Well, thank you once again for coming on the podcast. If people want to find out more about you, if people want to buy a copy of the book, where should they go to do those things?
Well, I, you know, obviously there is more than one place that you can buy books, so I'm always a bit wary of mentioning Amazon, but all of my books can be bought on Amazon. My publisher in the UK is Fourth Estate, which is HarperCollins. So you can also buy direct from the HarperCollins website. A lot of good bookshops have it in stock on their shelves, and some of my other books as well. In the US, it's Public Affairs, which is part of the Hachette imprint. And again, you know, it's all available on Amazon and also on Hachette and Public Affairs' websites. And it's what's very nice for me is there's an audio version of the book, which I read out myself. It just about killed me, but I read it. There's also an ebook for people who can't get access to bookshops or, you know, Amazon. If you're living in Africa, Amazon doesn't really work, but you can get an ebook copy delivered to your Kindle. So that there are many, many ways in which to access this book.
Fantastic. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you for being so interested.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.